I'd call this planning commission work session to order for Thursday, April 6, 2023. My name is Matt Swindell, and I'm the vice chair of the Clark County Planning Commission. Before we begin tonight, I'd like to announce that our planning commission work sessions are hybrid, both in person and in WebEx. For the virtual and in-person members of the planning commission and staff, please ensure that your microphones are turned off or muted unless you're speaking. There will not be any public comment during this work session, but members of the public can watch and listen. The evening's agenda is as follows. Number one, we're going to be talking about Title 40-510 PC Code Amendment. Number two on the agenda is the countywide planning policies. Number three is the housing code amendments updates. And number five, comp plan population projections. To begin with, let's see here. Susan Ellinger is going to be starting with Title 40-510 PC Code Amendments.
Sonia and Larissa and Matt, I think we were going to start with our housing code amendments. I think we moved around the agenda a little bit. We have our consultant here, so she was going to go first.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's start with the housing code amendments update then.
Okay. Thank you so much. And I'll just go ahead and start us off. Elizabeth, I just want to double check. Would you like to do your slides or would you like Larissa to advance for you?
I'm happy to do them myself just so that we don't have to do the back and forth.
Okay. Okay. Larissa, Elizabeth's going to do them for use her slides. Could you give her pass along the presenter rights? Perfect.
Okay. Yeah, it should all be set up.
Perfect. While you get going, Elizabeth, I'll just give a little introduction to you, to the Planning Commission members. So for those of you that were on the commission in 21, this is the implementation pieces, the beginning implementation pieces of the Housing Option Study and Action Plan that was before you and which you approved in early spring of 21. I believe, or late winter. We were given direction by County Council upon their approval in May of last year to move forward strategies, short-term strategies first that in the housing option study. Elizabeth's going to go a little bit into detail about how we're going about doing that, but so I'll hand it over to her. I'm pleased to introduce Elizabeth Decker from JET Planning, part of our consultant team that's helping us with this project. Thank you, Elizabeth. Take it away.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. Good evening, Chair Swindell and members of the Clark County Planning Commission. Appreciate you having me here to give you a preview of some of the code updates we've been working on to help implement the Housing Option Study and Action Plan, as Jackie mentioned. So we wanted to give you a quick refresher because it has been over a year since that plan was adopted and you last saw it. Give you start the overview of the code updates. We broke it down to go into detail of about half of them tonight, and we'll do the other half at your next month's work session. And then that sort of we'll review the schedule just to give you a sense of what's coming up next month, as well as the rest of the adoption process, and then leave some time tonight for your questions and comments so we can come back to you next month with additional information as appropriate. So to start off with a little bit of an overview, the key here about the Housing Options Study and Action Plan got kicked off in 2020, really looking to understand the local housing challenges with a focus on our project area of the unincorporated Vancouver Urban Growth Area. And we're looking in that area through the work to encourage creation of housing that's affordable to low and moderate income households not currently available within the project area. Looking for opportunities to remove regulatory barriers, as well as additional strategies to help provide broader range of high quality and flexible housing for future residents. And so the plan itself was adopted, as Jackie mentioned, last spring by the County Council in May. There's lots of different metrics. We've got 5 housing objectives, there's 4 topic areas and 3 different timeframes for those implementation strategies. All together, there's about 55 implementation strategies. And so this phase, we got direction, as Jackie mentioned, for staff to begin implementing a number of those strategies that are the short-term code-based strategies. And we further broke those down into two different phases. And the first phase is what's before you this evening, the middle housing and smaller single-family code updates. And we will be beginning work on the second phase, the multifamily and affordable housing code updates. Those will be in development starting this month, actually, but we'll come to you in the fall to share what we're learning and what we're proposing there. So our key findings that is driving these code updates, as well as, again, keep in mind, there's a whole range of strategies in the plan. But as you're no doubt aware, housing is getting increasingly expensive across the county and in the Vancouver urban growth area. So we're seeing wages increase in the study timeframe of about 12%. Meanwhile, rents increasing at twice that rate. And then astronomically, home sale prices increasing 95% over that same time period. So incredible growth, very difficult for families to continue to find housing that meets their budgets. And in that context, because it's such a broad range of housing needs, there's many different strategies and many different types of housing that will be needed to meet those needs. But particularly one option that emerged that's the focus of this phase of code amendments is middle housing, which is essentially in between single family detached and larger multifamily apartment projects. So, you know, in the middle in that context. And a lot of that housing is not currently present in the county, but really has some unique benefits and would allow the county to respond to some of the specific needs that were identified in the housing plan. So the reason that we're focusing in on middle housing with these code updates is that it helps provide opportunities to build smaller homes that can better suit the needs of smaller households. Right now, there are 60% of households in the county are 1 to 2 people. So having more housing options that fit that size of household is really valuable, as well as these are, again, because they're smaller homes, they can be built to a neighborhood scale, integrated into the existing residential low density areas, which is the preponderance of existing land as well as buildable land in the county. So we really have a broad base to work with to deploy these strategies. And then finally, middle housing can be less expensive than traditional larger single family homes. And that really helps it to be more attainable for what we're terming medium income households. That's the 80 to 120% AMI or average median income. And it can take a variety of forms, such as some of these on the right here, a triplex, townhouse, cottages, duplex. These are all options that are included, some already in the Clark County Code, but others in the proposed updates. And this also, it turns out, we started our work before this bill came into effect, but the proposed work dovetails really well with changes at the state level. In 2021, the HB 1220 directs Growth Management Act, through the Growth Management Act, directs counties and cities to plan for housing differently. And I believe that Jose Alvarez will be talking about this in more detail this evening. So I won't go into too much detail other than to point out that the county will be directed, like all other GMA counties, to plan directly for different income bands. And so this middle housing strategy and these smaller single family code update strategies really help provide more opportunities, again, for this 80 to 120% AMI income band that you see in the graphic on the right. So that's in the orange. And, you know, I think this graphic really well illustrates that middle housing is not going to solve all of these housing needs, but it really helps us hone in on one particular area that has been missing in the county's housing supply for a long time. In terms of the implementation approach, the code updates, as we've developed so far, have gone through a multi-month process. We kicked off last fall working with a technical housing code forum series. We had forum participants that were drawn from our project advisory group on the housing options, the housing plan earlier, as well as other planning commissioners, and members of the Development Engineering Advisory Board. We talked through the code concepts and drafted some language that you'll see that we'll talk about tonight. We also have had public review and comment opportunities to comment on the draft code. We had an open house last month. Comment period continues to be open. And then we'll be moving now as we kick off this work session. We are now into the legislative process for adoption. So this provides additional opportunity for input by Planning Commission and County Council, as well as public input at public hearings in front of both bodies. And right now we're working on these phase one amendments. We'll do this whole approach again for the phase two. So we're starting back at step one for phase two this month. And again, that'll be moving forward separate from these amendments that we're here to talk to you about tonight. So in these code updates, a few things to keep in mind, just overarching in terms of the scope. We're hoping to talk to you tonight a little bit more conceptually. I have all the code at my fingertips. I'm happy to talk through, you know, specific sections and subsections, but I know that sometimes it's easier to get a little bit broader view, especially as we're diving into it for this work session. So the 30,000 foot view of this is that these code updates are focused on what we're now going to term the low density residential districts. They're currently called the single family districts, but that's going to become a bit of a misnomer as we introduce more housing options. These are the R1 zones. And the focus is to enhance feasibility of the smaller single family detached homes, and then expand and refine options for middle housing, such as some of the housing types you see here, ADUs, which the county has permitted for several decades, duplexes, triplexes, quadplexes that have been pretty limited so far, cottage housing, the county has a lot of experience with, and so we have come back with a proposal to refine that and actually create a parallel path that we'll talk a bit about called the compact lot development, as well as townhouses, which again, the county has some experience with that, but we see some opportunities to expand where those are permitted. So in terms of the how we broke those code updates out into different concepts, we came up with six concept areas, and we're going to be talking about the first three of these tonight at our work session. But don't, you know, stay tuned, everyone, because we will have the other concepts that we're talking about at our upcoming May 4th work session. So this is just part one. We'll be talking more about that, the different clustered development options. Again, that's the cottage housing and the compact lot development option that I just mentioned that allow higher density of smaller single family lots in more of a coherent site plan. We'll be talking about what kinds of off-street parking is necessary to support this range of housing types we're working on, and then ways to streamline the permitting processes for all of the different single family and middle housing types that we're discussing. But for tonight, we're going to talk more about those smaller single family options and housing variety in neighborhoods. So the first concept is what we're terming using existing land more efficiently. As you all know, you know, within the urban growth boundary, there is only so much land designated for urban development. And so increasing the efficiency really just provides opportunities to fit more homes into the land that is already identified and planned for future public facilities. So the strategy here is to decrease the minimum lot sizes in those existing residential areas for single family homes, which will then allow a proportionate increase in the number of homes that can be built. We sized these at a pretty modest decrease of about 10 to 20% from the existing lot sizes. And then the updates in the code, we've carried the numeric standards, we've carried it through to make some corresponding adjustments to lot dimensions. So things like lot width, this remains proportional to the slightly decreased minimum lot size, and then made corresponding increases to the maximum densities to accommodate and reflect these lower minimum lot sizes. And what that means when we start mapping it out to the five R1 zones that are in the county, in our study area, the R120 currently has the largest lot size, right? The 20,000 square foot. We saw the opportunity there for the 20% reduction down to a 16,000 square foot minimum lot size. And then you can see how this carried through for the rest of the R1 zones. Some of them are closer to 10%, some are closer to 20%. One of the features that we were really aiming for with these in designing what the decreases would be, we wanted to make sure that whatever the decrease was, that it wasn't such a decrease that it became the minimum lot size for the next lowest zone. So probably the best way to explain that is, or the best example is, for example, the R16 zone is currently 6,000 square feet. We might have considered the 20% reduction to 5,000 square feet, but the R15 zone is currently 5,000 square feet. And we didn't want to have this result in sort of a stealth rezoning where we decreased the minimum lot sizes so much that the zone on paper sort of became the de facto different zone that already exists. So in that case, we chose we're proposing the 5,500 square foot minimum lot size so that we don't step on the toes of that next corresponding lot size. And then you can see what that looks like in terms of some small adjustments to lot width and lot depth. And then we also heard a lot from our participants in the forum that these increases in maximum lot coverage, when we get down to these smaller lot sizes being proposed for R16 and R15, that corresponding increases to maximum lot coverage, some of the developers felt those were very important to make housing fit onto those lots. So that is also part of the package. We did have an opportunity to talk with development engineering folks about what the stormwater implications were, and they assured us that there are ways to design stormwater systems that meet that. So those remain within the range of meeting those multiple objectives. The next concept is adding more housing variety to more neighborhoods. And that's sort of our conceptual way to talk about expanding these middle housing types. And so we saw opportunities to expand where duplexes, townhouses, and cottage housing are permitted. Right now they're permitted in some of the R1 zones, and we felt that those could be appropriate in all R1 zones. So that's the proposal before you. And currently triplexes and quadplexes are considered a form of multifamily housing, which means that they are subject to all the same regulations and review requirements as a 100-unit apartment complex, which essentially makes them infeasible to build. So we propose to create a new use category specifically for these very small 3 and 4 unit projects and treat them more akin to duplexes rather than 100-unit apartment complexes. So proposal to introduce those in a few of the R1 zones, the denser R1 zones. And then also a proposal to introduce the new compact lot development option, which is analogous to cottage housing in terms of the scale and density, but allows for a different site layout. So more of a traditional grid format rather than the clustering with the cottage homes. And then you'll see that we're continuing to permit ADUs in all zones as the county has done for decades now, but a little bit of a procedural refinement. To clarify the use table. And so this is a small snippet of the larger use table to show you what this looks like in terms of the housing types that are proposed. Single family homes and ADUs remain permitted in all zones. You see duplexes coming online in more zones as a proposed use. Those triplexes and quadplexes, as I mentioned, are proposed in the smaller zones, the R17.5 through R15. For townhouses, they're proposed to be permitted in all zones, but we proposed to scale the number of units so that the two attached townhouses in the R120 and the R110 are intended to offer home ownership options, but in terms of the scale and the form, it's analogous to a duplex. And that those 4-unit townhouses where you might have 4 attached units, we felt those were more analogous in form to triplexes and quadplexes. So those are proposed in the denser R1 zones. And then the compact lot and the cottage housing are proposed across all zones. Right now, cottages are not permitted in R120 and R110, and we saw the opportunity to, with this project, expand where those could be permitted. And when we start thinking about these different single family and middle housing concepts, there's at least, sort of two broad buckets of where these housing types could be built. And so the first is thinking about infill opportunities. So an existing neighborhood, an existing lot, where there just maybe is one vacant lot or a home that is, you know, has reached the end of its life cycle and is ready to be replaced. And that's where there could be an opportunity to infill with a duplex or a triplex and add a little bit more density in an existing neighborhood. But we would expect, particularly in the Clark County context, where many of the homes are newer, that the vast majority of these new housing types being proposed and the new development standards would apply to newer developments. So a larger development of multiple units, not necessarily infilling within an existing neighborhood, but both are permitted under the proposed zoning concepts. And because of that, because the housing is going to be in both, you know, infill scenarios as well as new development, the dimensional and design standards for these new middle housing types are an important piece to maintain the neighborhood scale and ensure that these types of housing can be compatible within neighborhoods with a mix of housing types, including those that are currently predominantly single family detached. So we set the lot sizes for these different middle housing types. The proposal is based on compatibility with it's tied to the lot sizes for single family homes and builds off of those. We did use a little bit of offered a bit of an incentive in terms of offering a tiered lot coverage, meaning that you get the proposal would allow a slight increase in lot coverage for each additional unit proposed on a lot. And then there are some site design standards. We stayed away from architectural design, things like should it be a Queen Anne or a contemporary or a craftsman type of style. We stayed completely away from that because that's not featured in the county code at present. But we did propose some site design standards for a handful of these middle housing uses to better balance the living and residential space with the parking areas along the street frontage. And I can give you a little look at what that looks like. So this is the table summarizing the proposed lot sizes for the middle housing types. Across the top, you see those single family detached home lot sizes that we talked about. Duplexes are proposed at the same minimum lot sizes as the single family homes. And the key there, we heard from some developers that they thought if they were building from scratch, it would be really important to build a slightly larger lot to have more room for two units. And that absolutely remains an option. However, in order to expand the number of lots that are eligible to build duplexes, best practice is really to allow the analogous minimum lot sizes for single family homes and duplexes so that, you know, 90% of the existing lots are able to add that duplex rather than needing to create a lot from scratch with that, you know, slightly larger lot before you can qualify for the duplex. And then that you'll see the triplex and the quadplex lots are slightly larger, and they are generally analogous to the townhouse lot sizes at about no less than 2,000 square feet per unit. Okay, and then here's that last piece that I was talking about in terms of the site design and balancing the street frontage. For these new compact lot concepts that we're introducing, the triplexes and the quadplexes, we wanted to introduce some design standards that would pull the entryways, make those a key feature, bring them a little bit closer to the street, a little bit more visible. And then on the other hand, or the other side of the coin, to cap garages and driveways at 50% of the front facade, so that walking down a street or coming down the sidewalk, you're not just seeing endless rows of garages. And you can really see the difference in terms of what these standards could accomplish. These are two duplexes in my neighborhood that happen to be next to each other. And you can see the one on the left, really, those garages are more prominent. You're really just getting a lot of garage and not much interaction, visual connection, eyes on the street, versus the one on the right really has more opportunity. Same number of garages, same number of driveways, still fits on the lot, but those entryways are a little bit more prominent, a little bit more opportunity for neighborhood connection. So that's the concepts that we have tonight. I wanted to leave a little bit of time for your comments. As you can see from the schedule, we are officially underway with our adoption schedule at this work session tonight. We have several meetings with the Development Engineers and Advisory Board coming up in April and May. We'll be back to you in May to discuss the remainder of the concepts and any follow-up questions that you have about the concepts discussed tonight before we move into a public hearing later next month. And then based on your recommendation, we'll be looking to move on to County Council for a work session and to continue the adoption process. So thank you for having me here and happy to answer any questions and hear your initial feedback on the code concepts.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Elizabeth. That was a great job on that. I guess I'll just start down the list, and honestly, I don't know exactly who all is attending tonight. I know, is it just the three of us?
No, Brian.
I can't see him. Okay, Steve Marash is there?
Steve Marash is here, and Bryant is also an attending.
Right. Okay, I can't see him. So, okay, great. Well, we'll start with Steve Marash. Steve, do you have any questions?
No, thank you. Very good discussion.
Great. Bryant, do you have any questions?
Good presentation. I like the thinking. The question that comes to mind is on the going from 5,000 square foot lot to a 4,000 square foot lot. If you just reduce that by 10% and go from 5,000 to 4,500, what's the loss in terms of efficiency in terms of total number of houses?
Yeah, thanks for that question. And we actually, our initial proposal was 4,500 square feet, and we heard from the forum participants, particularly some developers, that they felt it was important to create this option to go to 4,000 square feet for smaller single family. But I appreciate the question, and just to say that we spent a lot of time thinking about that. That's also my long way of saying I could do some analysis about the difference in those numbers and get back to you next month on the exact difference.
Thanks, Elizabeth. That's good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, great question. Eldon, do you have any questions?
Oh, I have two questions. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't understand that tiered lot coverage. Could you explain, give me an example of that?
Oh, yeah, thank you. I did go through that. Let's go back to this. I think I might have accidentally skipped this slide, which would explain why you still have questions. Must have just advanced too quickly. So the proposed lot coverage, as I mentioned, it's 50% in all of the R1 zones for all housing types currently. And part of the proposal, again, that we heard about single family homes was as we move to those smaller lot sizes in these zones, there was an interest to slightly increase the lot coverage for single family detached. But what we also wanted to add in, you know, on these larger lots, R120 is proposed at 16,000 square feet. Well, 50% of a 16,000 square foot lot is 8,000 square feet. You're not gonna hit that kind of a building footprint for a duplex, you know, even with a duplex with two units. So we didn't see a real need to adjust those. But here in the smaller lot sizes with the R17.5 through R15, it's proposed that essentially you get an additional 5% of lot coverage for each additional unit that's proposed on the lot. And that just gives, you know, a modest additional building footprint to better accommodate those additional homes. But not so much so, hopefully, that the bulk and scale become incompatible with other uses on the block.
That helped a lot.
Great.
And I have one other question.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. Did you have anything else to add on that?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I'm sure it helped because I think we skipped this slide, so.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, apologies.
So, yeah, the other question I had was near the end about the garage and the door not being more than 50% of the facade, that one right there. Mm-hmm. And you said it had a better neighborhood connection. How do you grade that? I don't understand how that, I mean, if I'm in a neighborhood, I don't care if the facade on the left is there. To me, I'm just as connected to that neighbor as I am to the other one. What was the basis for that?
Sure. Fair feedback. It is fairly subjective. I have heard this described as the trick-or-treat test, as in if you were a young child that was motivated to get candy and you're walking down the street in your neighborhood, can you find the front door to knock on it to go trick-or-treating? And so I think that's sort of a funny way of alluding to, you know, the home on the right. I think it would be a little bit easier to find those doors and a little easier for those residents, if they're coming out the doors, to see somebody walking by the sidewalk, wave, say hi, you know, just create those, you know, see what's going on, as opposed to the house on the left. And I don't actually know these neighbors. So, you know, again, this is fairly subjective, but when the front door is so far behind, it's a little harder just to even get a sense of what's happening on the street, see what your neighbors are up to.
So it is pretty subjective, but
yes.
I know a lot of people take a lot of pride in having a great garage and they want to showcase that. I mean, face it, you look at houses for sale, say, hey, I've got a shop, or I've got a double wide garage. I don't know. It seems very subjective, and I understand the trick or treat principle, but there are people who take a lot of pride in showing off their garages.
Yeah, fair point.
All right. Thanks, Owen. Brian, you have any questions?
Sure. Thanks. Brian Halbert. a few comments. I like the lot size adjustments that you're proposing. The reductions seem to make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I do like the balanced street frontage. That at the 50%, you know, out walking my dog, there's neighborhoods that are just garages, garage doors for blocks and blocks. And in fact, you can't even tell where their front door is. And on your picture on the house on the right with the garage, with the front doors moved forward, it just seems far more appealing, far more street appeal than just garage doors lined up for blocks. So I support that. I like that. One thing I didn't understand completely is the housing types and the cluster developments in the R20 and R10 zones. And how does a cluster development in an R10 or an R20 zone fit into a neighborhood that's already existing? And it seems like a bunch of small homes next to single family homes on R10 lots. Is that kind of what you're seeing as infill?
I think that it's going to depend a bit on the context, of course, where these existing multi-acre sites are in R10 or R120 zones. They're not necessarily completely surrounded by the existing development. It really just depends on the context.
We've got an echo. I think someone might be not muted in the room.
Thank you.
Sorry, that might have been me leaving my mic on. I'll turn it off while Elizabeth is talking.
Yes, so context dependent, of course. But I think the other thing to understand about the cottage and the cluster development is that it is defined as scaling to the existing zone. Which is to say that the cottage and cluster development is proposed to allow 200% of the density of the existing zone. And so what the county has seen to date is that cottage housing has been proposed in R17.5 through R15 that already has a fairly high density. And so then doubling that is a much smaller footprint. When we look at expanding cottage housing into the R120 and R110 zone, it won't be as dense because it will only be twice as much as the existing home. So right now the proposal, you know, as you saw, was 1600 square feet in R120. And so a cottage home could only be developed at the equivalent of 8,000 square feet per home. So we're not necessarily getting down to the smallest lots that you've seen in cottage housing to date. It would be scaled to the R110 and the R120 zones.
Yeah, thanks, Elizabeth. That makes sense. And one other question. You mentioned that you've had some public comments or that you did a public presentation. What kind of feedback are you getting from the public in general?
Yeah, thanks. I'll also give Jackie a chance to chime in here. We had an open house last month, and I think it would be fair to say we mostly had just questions, clarifications, a lot of interest in what it would mean. But I'd say more just people trying to understand at this point. What would you say, Jackie?
I agree. And as we continue to move towards your hearing, there may be more comment specific than questions, but it does seem like we're getting more, at least with that informational meeting, some questions, but I'd have to go back and double check that, and I can do that.
Yeah, thanks. Just always curious how, you know, neighborhoods look at this and respond, and you know, how they're feeling about more homes or more denser homes in their neighborhoods. And I think it's absolutely going the right direction. I applaud the way it's going. So thanks for what you're doing.
Thanks.
Okay. I guess I would, along with that, the trick-or-treater test, I'd do the porch pirate test. And how apt is that porch pirate going to want to walk all the way down the side of that house to get that package? So you go either way on that one. I really do like the facade on the, where the porch is out in the front. It does really. I built a lot of homes like the ones on the left, and it was the way I had to. It was the way I had to design it based on what I had to deal with. So I do like the opportunity to give that to them to do build a much nicer facade on the home. So I hate to see us take away the ability for someone to do what they want to with their home as they're building it. I'd like to create more opportunity rather than restrict. So that's my only comment on that. And then I, along with what Brian had said, every time we talk about higher densities and changing, reducing lot sizes within existing zoning, we've had meetings in the past where the residents in certain areas in Hazeldale they were very, very worried and concerned about parking, about, you know, their parks. Those kind of things, and as we get further into this, I do want to make sure we're looking at as we create more, when we get more specific, I guess, further down the road, we're more specific in what we're doing here. What does that look like for parks? What does that look like for parking? What are the restrictions we're putting on parking, and how many cars can they have? Blah blah blah. There's a lot to talk about there. So, but I really like the way this is going because we do need more affordable housing, and honestly, the only way you can do it is smaller lots and smaller houses, or go up three story like you've proposed. So, I think great job, very very well done, and very well thought out. Thank you.
Thanks, and we'll be talking about parking in more detail next month.
Fantastic. Commissioner Swindell, I wasn't sure. Yeah. We still have Jack is online too. I don't know if he was overlooked by accident. He's also online.
Sorry, Jack. I didn't know you were there. Do you have any questions, Jack?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so I had, I think my first comment is, I would like to see us be more aggressive with some of the lot size reductions. I'm currently developing, you know, a 1900 square foot house on a 30 foot wide lot. So it's a 3000 square foot lot, you know, in downtown Vancouver. I have a project on 16th and Markle that I did three detached single family 1800 square foot houses on a 5500 square foot lot. So there's, when we look at what is possible from a developer standpoint, I like to see as much flexibility as possible. Some of the, when I think of some of the stuff that I hope to develop in the future, I think it may be more like a Notting Hill type neighborhood in England, where you have, or even like New York or something, where you have like a front stoop that comes right down to the walkway. And you almost have a split duplex where you have a down level and an up level. But that requires some pretty significant, like, you know, zero, like you can go zero lot line almost to the to the street. And this works especially well around like alleys and things like that. I did notice in the code there was some provision that was written in there with an alley access that you could reduce the frontage. How far was, does that allow you to go all the way to the property line, or was there a, there was not, I didn't see a definition in there in that.
I don't have the number off the top of my head, but I can look into it for the next meeting.
Okay.
I know that we'll talk more about alleys and parking at our next meeting and can talk about what some of the trade-offs are.
Okay. And then when I look at some things that I would like to see as far as like when we talk about clean water and when we get into our higher densities, is if we could do almost like from our infiltration systems, if we can do community infiltration systems, or even under, like if you had an alley, you can have the infiltration system underneath the alley and not having to do it just, you know, as a single site setup. I had a question on, so if we're doing we're encouraging like townhome development and we have an infill lot, say call it an 8,000 square foot lot, and I go in and put technically a duplex, but I build them as townhomes. Is that always a duplex, or in order to sell them off individually, would you have to condoize it, or does it by right become a two legal townhome lots without doing a full subdivision process?
Well, there's a couple opportunities I think that we're proposing. Oh, sorry, this is the slide I was looking for. So let's say that you had that 8,000 square foot in the R16 zone, right?
Yep.
Pretty common zone. So as I mentioned, townhouses are being proposed at a 2,000 square foot site minimum per unit. And so it would require a subdivision, but you could take that 8,000 square feet, divide it into four 2,000 square foot lots and build four townhouses. If duplexes were built instead, they could either be condoized, but they wouldn't automatically get divided without a subdivision. But there is an opportunity before, you know, outright to create those lots.
So when we're looking at trying to create opportunities for home ownership, the subdivision process is onerous, painful, and expensive. So you would, it would never pencil to subdivide a single lot into two lots. It almost would never pencil. Is there a way by code we can make it like, I mean, in Portland, you can do a buy right is like $1,500 to drop a line down the center of your lot. And then you can do a zero lot line, you know, building. So a townhome on that. Is there any provision in this code that would allow us to do that? So we could actually create, because the difference is I would go in and develop and then keep them as rentals versus I'm going and develop and selling them individually.
Sure.
And so the goal is home ownership in that middle housing, which I'm a huge proponent of because all of the benefits of home ownership and all that. Is there an opportunity within this code to make it, you know, by right, you can do that. We can take a lot, build a townhome, drop a line down the center, and then sell them off individually.
No, this is a short answer. And as I've done a lot of work on Oregon implementing their middle housing, and there was additional state legislation passed that enabled cities to offer that opportunity. But as I understand, the Washington subdivision law simply doesn't offer counties or cities that option right now. So we don't have an alternative to that process.
Okay. So it's a state legislative thing that needs to be fixed. It's not a city or a code thing. And are you 100% sure on that, or is it?
No, I would say I'm 90% sure, but I'd be happy to look into it further. But I believe that I don't know of any workaround to the Washington State Subdivision Code at present.
Okay. I know there's something in the legislature right now that they're working on, but I don't know if that's
fantastic.
Yeah.
There's so much happening. I can look into
it. Yeah, there is a lot. Yeah, I think that was it. Oh, my other comment was in the, and I'll have to read through it a little more carefully, but some of the setbacks that were triggered by easements seemed a little bit problematic in some of the codes. And so it was, maybe it was a little bit of clarification that if you have a power line utility easement, that your setback doesn't start from the edge of the power line utility easement, or some of the driveway, you know, private drive easements, that it, that doesn't trigger setbacks, especially as we get into these narrow lot type things, it can create some additional issues. So I didn't know how much thought had been put into that, or if it was just, yeah. So
thanks. Yeah, I can look into those.
Cool. Thank you.
All right. Great questions, Jack. Those really thoughtful questions there. Okay, with that, are we ready to move? I'm not sure which direction we're going. We're going to number one now, the title code amendment. Are we going to there?
Yes. Yes, we're going to do 4510.
Okay. Susan. All right, take it away.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me? Okay, great. Good evening. For the record, my name is Susan Ellinger, and I'm a planner with Community Planning. I'm going to be discussing docket item CPZ 2022-00016, and that proposes a modification to Clark County Code 4510-040 to clarify that all proposed amendments to the comprehensive plan and development regulations require review before the Planning Commission. Next slide, please. I'll be going through the background of why this change is needed, give you some details about what exactly is being requested, and outline the public outreach that occurred. Then I'll outline the staff findings and how the change complies with state and local regulations, review the staff recommendation, and outline the review process and next steps. Next slide, please. So tonight we're going to be discussing the review process that's required for Type 4 legislative decisions, and these include comprehensive plan and text amendments with associated zone changes. They also include modifications to the development regulations, the arterial atlas, and the shoreline master program. With the code change that was completed in 1996, Planning Commission review of Type 4 decisions changed from being required to being optional. And the 1996 staff report didn't address why that original change was made, but staff presume that it was added to exempt certain types of reviews that need immediate consideration by county council. An exception from the Planning Commission review for some legislative decisions was added in May 2019. That exception includes reviews that need immediate consideration by county council, such as interim actions, moratoria, and emergency legislation, although the code is still unclear if these are the only types of applications that are exempted. Next slide, please. So to help clarify that issue, staff is recommending the proposed changes outlined in Exhibit A that will require review by the Planning Commission for all Type 4 decisions other than those that are specifically accepted from review. And this will provide for a consistent procedure for all amendments to the comprehensive plan and development regulations, and also allow for additional public participation options by including Planning Commission work session and public hearings. Next slide, please. Excuse me. So public involvement for this item involved inclusion in the Community Planning Work Program by County Council in December of 2021. The proposal was also submitted to the Department of Commerce for 60-day review on March 14th. A CEPA determination of non-significance was published on April 3rd, and a legal notice for the Planning Commission hearing was published on April 5th, 2023. Slide, please. I'm now going to summarize some of the findings and recommendations from the staff report. The Clark County Unified Development Code, or Title 40, consolidates all development-related regulations, land use, zoning, critical areas, and environmental protection code provisions. Title 40 is required to be consistent with the 20-year comprehensive growth management plan. amendments to the Clark County Code may respond to substantial change in policy, better implement applicable comprehensive plan policies, or reflect changes in federal or state law. As I mentioned earlier, making the proposed change will provide for a consistent procedure for all amendments to the comprehensive plan and development regulations and provide additional public participation options. As shown on this slide, there are several requirements in state law, the comprehensive plan, and county code that support broad public outreach. Adoption of the proposal would help better implement all of those provisions. And based on those findings, staff is recommending approval of the proposal. Next slide, please. So a little bit about the process and next steps. There was a work session yesterday with council. Today we're doing the Planning Commission work session. On April 20th, we'll have a Planning Commission hearing. And then on June 20th, we'll have the council hearing. And next slide, please. And that actually concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, great. We'll start with Bryant. We'll start with you first this time. Any questions?
Not at this time, thank you.
Okay, Brian, you got any questions?
Could you, Brian Halbert, can you give us an idea what is exempt from this still?
It's moratoria. Let me find that. So interim actions, moratoria, and emergency legislation. Those would only go to council. They would not go to Planning Commission.
Great, thanks. No other questions.
Okay.
All right, Steve, do you have any questions?
No, thank you, no questions.
All right, Eldon, you have any questions?
Just one, hasn't Clark County already been involving the Planning Commission in all those?
So in general, yes. There have been a few actions that have not gone to the Planning Commission, and so we wanted to ensure that all of them did go to the Planning Commission and make the code, just clarify the code and make it clear for anyone looking into it that everything needed to go to the Planning Commission.
So this was all generated by the staff then, saying that we just need clarity on this?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
All right. Jack, you have any questions?
No questions, thank you.
All right, and I have no questions, so what was that? I think I remembered everybody this time. So with that said, I think fantastic job on that one. And I believe, Susan, you're doing our next one again on the countywide planning policies, correct?
I am.
All right. Well, take it away.
Okay. One sec.
Thank you, Larissa.
Thank you, Larissa.
Mm-hmm.
And just so you know, oh, it went away. Okay. So for the record, again, I'm Susan Ellinger, and I'm a planner with Community Planning. And I'm going to be discussing the next docket item, which is CPZ 2022-00015. And that proposes an addition of a process to amend the countywide planning policies within the comprehensive plan. Next slide, please. Again, I'll be going through the background of why this change is needed, give you some details about what exactly is being requested, and outline the public, the public outreach that occurred. Then I will outline the staff findings and how the change complies with state and local regulations, review the staff recommendation, and outline the review process and next steps. Next slide, please. So I'll start with some background. The creation of the countywide planning policies, or CWPP for short, is required as part of the Growth Management Act. And in this legislation, the countywide planning policies are defined as statements used for establishing a countywide framework from which county and city comprehensive plans are developed and to ensure that city and county comprehensive plans are consistent. So the Clark County CWPP were developed in 1992 in a process that included all of the jurisdictions within the county. But the existing countywide planning policies do not clearly include a process for how they can be amended or interpreted. So therefore, staff initiated an amendment to clarify that procedure. Next slide, please. The proposed changes to the comprehensive plan are included in Exhibit A, and they involve the addition of a new countywide planning policy, CWPP 1.1.13, and that outlines that the application process and submittal requirements for amendment or interpretation of the CWPP. The new policy also specifies how the review process for these requests would work. The process is based on what has been done in previous periodic comprehensive plan reviews that were done in 2004, 2007, and 2016. And the countywide planning policies were updated successfully as a part of each of those projects. So the process first involves review by a technical coordinating committee. We also call this the TCC. And the TCC includes staff from all of the jurisdictions, towns, cities, and the county, the Cowlitz Indian Tribe, and the Regional Transportation Council. And the proposed language specifies that the TCC would use a consensus-based process to develop a recommendation to the county council. If the group, for some reason, can't agree on a recommendation, then the proposal will be forwarded through the remainder of the process with a summary of the TCC discussion. And after the TCC considers the proposal, then it's forwarded to the county council. And if approved by the county council, then staff from each jurisdiction would bring the proposal through each of their own jurisdiction's approval process. Next slide, please. So the public involvement for this item involved inclusion in the community planning work program by the county council in December of 2021. The TCC, or Technical Coordinating Committee, that I discussed earlier, reviewed the proposal in the January, February, and March 2023 meetings. The item was also submitted to the Department of Commerce for 60-day review on March 14th. A CEPA determination of non-significance was published on April 3rd, and a legal notice for the Planning Commission hearing was published on April 5th. Next slide, please. So I'm now going to summarize some of the staff findings and recommendations from the staff report. And as outlined in the Clark County Code, the county can approve a plan text change only when the amendment is consistent with all of the applicable requirements of the GMA, the Washington Administrative Code, and the comprehensive plan, including the countywide planning policies, community framework plan, and the capital facilities plan. So approval of the proposal will allow compliance with WAC 365-196-305, which includes recommended procedures for review and amendment of countywide planning policies. It will also allow the comprehensive plan to more clearly meet RCW 3670A215, which requires provision of methods to resolve disputes among jurisdictions relating to the countywide planning policies. The amendment also supports RCW 3670A140 and GMA Goal 11, which both address public participation in the development and amendment of comprehensive plans. Finally, the amendment supports many policies within the existing comprehensive plan that support collaboration and coordination between Clark County and its cities and towns. So based on all of those findings, staff is recommending approval of this proposal. Next slide, please. Similar to my other. Next slide, please.
Susan, are you there?
I am.
You like? Oh, you
we just lost you for a second.
Oh, whoops. Should I go backwards or am I okay?
I think just go over this slide. You're okay. Then you're good.
Okay. Just really quickly, we had a work session with council on April 5th. We've got tonight's Planning Commission work session on April 6th. Planning Commission hearing will be on April 20th, and we've got the council hearing on June 20th. And next slide, please. And that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, fantastic. Bryant, do you have any questions?
Matt, none at this time. Thank you.
All right, Brian, you have any questions?
Yeah, Susan. So what kind of requests have been made that triggered this amendment to the planning policy, or just an example of what's been brought forth that that you're saying, hey, we need to change the way we're doing this right now?
So really, the only reason for, and I'm sorry, I had an echo again. Thank you. The only reason for adding this provision is because it's suggested in state law and we don't have it. I don't know that there have been amendments, like I mentioned, in the last three periodic review processes. Those have been taken to the TCC, discussed, and then brought forward. The last one, there actually was one in 2020. And that added some provisions to the countywide planning policies to address the Cowlitz tribe and the interaction between the county and the Cowlitz tribe for planning some planning activities. But I don't know that there's been any issues that have caused the need to address this. It's really to address state law better.
Great, thanks.
Sure.
All right, Steve, you have any questions?
No, not at this time. Thanks.
All right. Eldon?
None for me.
Jack, you have any questions?
No questions. Thank you.
All right. And I don't have any questions on that either. Seems pretty straightforward. And with that, I believe we're moving on to the comp plan population projections. And that's going to be with Jose, correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Hey, Jose, do you want to present? Because I do not see the presentation online.
No, I can do that.
Okay, I'll make you the presenter. Mm-hmm.
Can y'all see the slides okay?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So this evening, just as an informational item to the PC, we just want to share with you the 20-year population projection presentation that we've shared with council yesterday in work session and with our technical committee this earlier today. So let's go. So the overview of the presentation is just some historic population data, the yearly growth rates since 2001, some past projections and census numbers, review the projection numbers from OFM, the middle, medium, low and high, why the projection is sort of declining in certain instances, and then the connection between House Bill 1220, the population and housing, and new tools provided by Commerce for us to plan for. Just to show you some what the next steps are going to be, and then open for comments and questions that you may have. So this slide just shows the annual population growth from 2001 to 2022. The orange line is the yearly growth rate. And then in the blue columns, that's the actual growth. Part of the kind of the point of this slide is to just show the variability in population growth over time, and then also to show that sort of as you get increasing that population base, the percentages, the relative percentages, you have the same amount of growth, but the relative percentages declines over time. The historic population and OFM population projections. So this graph is showing in the black, the historic population. This dashed line in the middle is where we currently are. And so in 2022, and these are the projections from OFM from 2002 to 2022, they update their 20-year GMA projections every 5 years. So we have the 2002, the 2007, the 2012, 2017, and then the 2022 projections. And this is just kind of to show how those four previous projections compare to the actual 2020 population. And sort of as you can see, for the most part, the projections are pretty close to the OFM middle or medium projection, which they think is the most likely. In the blue, you'll see that that's the 1 year, the 2012, where the projection was below, the projection, the forecast was below what actually occurred. And again, that 2012 projection was highly influenced by the census in 2010 and the downturn in the economy. This is a comparison, again, of that same information for the past OFM population projections with the actual census values. So you can see that the bars, the colored bars show the different years for the population projections, 2002 through 2017. In the middle is the medium projection. Just the OFM for medium and middle is they use it interchangeably. So that's why we refer to both. And so you can see how close that their projections were for the year 2020 relative to what actually occurred in 2020, represented by that 503, 311, the red horizontal line going across. So on the high, you can see how much above the 20. The projection, the high was from what actually occurred in 2020. Go. Okay, so this is historic growth over 10 year intervals starting from essentially 1970 to 2020. The 10 year growth period and the average annual population growth rate. So as you'll see, sort of in the 1990s to 2000 period, we had the highest amount of actual growth. It was 107,000 folks that moved into Clark County in that 10-year period, and that was a 3.79 average annual population growth rate for those 10 years. In 2010 and 2020, the roughly 80 and 77,000. Again, as you'll see, the between the 2010 and the 2020, the actual number of folks that came to the county was pretty close, but the annual population growth rate seems to be more significantly different, the 2.11 and the 1.7%. And that's a function of the base getting bigger as we go along. This is similar information showing that those 10-year incremental periods and in the blue bars, so you can see what that peak growth was, 1990 to 2000, which is 3.79%, 107,000 folks. And then the two subsequent bars are 2000 to 2010, it's about 80,000 and about a 2% growth rate. And then 2010 to 2020 is the 77,000 folks, and that's roughly 1.7%. So the population projections from OFM for this 20-year projection ranges from the low of 576,151 to the high of 791,809. The middle, again, is what OFM deems most likely to occur, is the 698,416. And then how those numbers are broken out into percentages. We calculate the percentages. OFM doesn't provide us percentages. They'll just provide us the range. And again, and then we use the compounded annual rate of growth for those projections. And this is, these 20-year projections are from 2025 to 2045. And in the next slide, I will show you that there's a different base number in 2025 for each of those projections. So we're currently at 529,900 for 2022 estimate. The estimate for the base in 2025 for the middle projection is 543,507. For the high, it's 586,988. And then for the low is 510,897, which is about 10,000 below where we're currently at. So that creates an issue. And the way OFM describes this is like I said, the middle is the most likely to occur, and based on their projections being off, they provide this sort of band, which is the low and the high. So this chart again shows that similar information, the additional people for the high in the gray, the middle is the blue, and then the darker gray is the low, and then the percentage projections, and you see that is declining over time for each of these, and this is broken up into 5-year increments. So 2020 to 2025, 2025 to 2030, 2030 to 2035, and on into 2045. And so it's just showing for those 5 years, you can see those blue lines. It's just 40,000, just under 40,000 as you move on, but the population growth rate goes down from 1.42 to 1.12% over time in those, for those 5-year increments. And that's how we end up with that 1.26% overall for that 20-year projection. So this is the components of population change, which is the births, deaths. So this is the natural increase. It shows the projected births and deaths. And what you can see is our population is getting older. And so the forecast is for, you know, the baby boom generation going through that. And we're going to have the deaths is going to increase to such a rate that it's going to cross with the projected births out there at, you know, in the 2045, 2050. So there's not going to be much natural increase outside of this 20-year period, but it's narrowing the gap through this 20-year forecast. And so while there's just going to be a decline in the natural increase, and most of the population growth is going to come from migration. So this slide shows the kind of the projected total growth with the net migration in the blue in the middle. You can see that's accounting for most of the growth over this period, where the natural increase is sort of flatlining and then declining. And then the net migration, which historically has been pretty volatile, that's sort of dipping in the first 5 years and then going up progressively slower as we get towards the end of the period. Let me stop here to see if you have any questions before I go on to the next part with the connection, the House Bill 1220. Is that okay? Or would you want me to continue on?
So if you'd like us to stop and we can do that, I can just run through the roll here and see what people have for you. So with that, Bryant, do you have any questions at this time?
Jose, just probably a social question, but do you know what causes that cycle in terms of the migration going up and then all of a sudden it's a dip and then we're back up again and it looks like we're going to dip again? Is it jobs? Available housing?
I think a lot of it is economic. I think it follows our economic cycles. There's also, you know, changes in, you know, the migration is both within the U.S. and external migration from foreign countries. There was when I first started working at the county, migration was a lot of younger folks coming to Clark County with children when they were at school age. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking for housing. So the housing availability was a big thing. So it just kind of changes over time, depending. So that's a lot of it is the different economic cycles.
Okay, and so you think it's going to dip again?
Well, this isn't my forecast. This is off them.
Gotcha. Okay,
just to be clear.
Okay, all right. No, thank you, though. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Okay, Brian, do you have any questions?
Yeah, no questions. I like the graphs. I think they're clear, and the explanations behind them are really helpful.
All right, Steve, do you have any questions for him?
No questions. Thank you.
All right, Eldon?
No, Jose, you're doing a great job on this, but just like everything, anytime you're doing a forecasting, it's based on what assumptions are made and the devil's in the details on that stuff. We don't have time to get into that, nor would you know the answers to all those. But so far, I don't have any questions on what you proposed so far.
Okay, Jack, do you have any questions?
No, I mean, I struggle with the projected, just because it is those incredibly large assumptions. I would be
certainly interested if there was an opportunity to talk to somebody in the OFM or see a presentation on how they derive their information in numbers, because, you know, it doesn't make sense, like, organically, I guess, to me, of how they're coming with decrease in migration when we have record increases in migration in the U.S. and just trying to understand, I'm like, well, how does that, are the U.S. total U.S. population continues to grow. A lot of it is from migration. So then how does that all start factoring in? Because it will affect us. And this is really consequential over the long term for affordability and housing of the number we pick here. So I'd certainly like to have as good of an understanding as possible.
Yeah. And I think the country overall is growing, but at a much slower rate than we have been. And that's the state overall of Washington. And so what I can say is that OFM really starts this with the state level, and they sort of work this down. They're looking at a lot of historical data that's they have a technical report that I can provide you that they use for the 2017 projections. They haven't updated that yet. We're working with them. They're going to have that updated, but so it's a lot of the recent information, a lot of the demographic information, and a lot of there's definitely some assumptions, but part of this is that this is their kind of bailiwick. They are kind of the experts in this, and they've had a really good track record, with the exception of that 2012. And that's really the message that we're trying to convey.
Sure. I guess my understanding is never trust an expert. And I guess more than anything of if they were to I don't know if they offer to staff or an opportunity to do a webinar where they kind of really go through some of the real technical data that, you know, would to where we just have a better grasp. I'd certainly be willing to sit through something like that to have a greater understanding. That's all.
Yeah. And I would say that we did have a presentation from OFM. I think it was the 28th of March. And so that's on the council and our webpage. So you can take a look at that as well. Okay. Any other questions?
I was just going to make a comment that I attended a luncheon today with the Multifamily Housing Northwest, and it based on what I saw, a lot of the very, very large investment companies that are looking at the Portland area are not really excited about Portland and are really looking elsewhere because of politics and the policies and rent caps and all that jazz, and all of that affects us. So and they're seeing a recession, they're seeing doom and gloom, they're seeing people are going bye-bye and those investments are going away. So I see a projection like this, and I think it's maybe even a little bit aggressive from what they were saying. No, I'm not saying I think it's aggressive, but from what they were thinking that this is that medium projection is. But based on what their history is and projecting that medium, it sounds reasonable to me. But anyway, thanks, Jose. You can move forward.
Okay. All right. So House Bill 1220, like Elizabeth mentioned in the earlier presentation, was adopted in 2021 and really requires us to plan for sort of all economic segments of the population. And it's really kind of focusing on these income bands kind of below 80%. It's 30 to 50, 50 to 80, 80 to 100, 100 plus. But really trying to incorporate that into our local planning efforts. having projected need for emergency housing, shelters, and permanent supportive housing. And Department of Commerce has created some tools for local planning agencies to try to account for that, and they've linked it to these OFM population projections. And I'll show you a couple of slides and how they tied that together. But the other guidance that they provided is related to this moderate density housing options within UGAs, which is what the housing option studies that we've been working with Elizabeth on and that you're going to be considering. In terms of, they're also providing guidance on adequate housing and doing a land capacity analysis for these types of housing where we haven't done this before, trying to match the income, area median income with the right zoned land that's affordable to those segments. So part of the guidance is looking at doing capacity analysis based on zoning, which our vacant buildable lands model is not based on zoning, but on an aggregation based on, it's based on comp land at this point. It's really getting, refining that model and getting into more detail of the zoning for each land type. So we've been working with our GIS to help facilitate that. And with the cities, we're gonna need their input to get those numbers to apply to each of those zones. For residential zoning, it's, you know, there's usually ranges and density within within those residential zones, but it's trying to actually get to a number. And then in for certain jurisdictions, they're beginning to allow housing in some of their commercial zones. And so trying to get an estimate of what the density is and what they expect to see in those commercial areas and what percentage of land that's commercial they think is going to be residential in the future. And this is particularly an issue with the city of Vancouver, but it's not limited to them. Other jurisdictions are having the same issue where they're allowing for residential in zones that are that are commercial. So it's more of a mixed use situation. And finally, there's a guidance on examining racially disparate impacts, displacement and inclusion exclusion in housing policies and regulations, and developing policies to address those. And that's going to require some additional analysis on our part, and we're waiting for some additional guidance from Commerce to address that. And that's something we'll be looking at as part of the comp plan update. So this is the Housing for All planning tool that the Department of Commerce has developed. And so this is for all jurisdictions. So in step one to I selected Clark County, the projection year is 2045. You can enter the population target. Doesn't have to be the low, medium, or high, but I just used this as an example. And so what you'll see there is the state is estimating based on that projected population, how much total future housing is going to be needed in 2045. And they're subtracting out their estimate of housing supply as of 2020. So in that red circle, the net new housing needed for the county based on the low prop projection is 54,466 units. And then then you can see those by income bands. So the ones I've highlighted are, you know, what we would think of as sort of below market rate housing that would need some either some sort of subsidy to be able to make that. And it's a significant amount in this case. It's about 30,000 of the 54,000 units. So the next one is going to show this information for the middle projection, and that's the red circle number is the 107,000 new units. And again, breaking it out by that, the income bands, this is about 49% of the total number of units are gonna need to be that below 80%. And these numbers are 2020 to 2045. So it may be some discount in that as we move forward. And then the high is 147,000 units. And this is maybe 40% of the total is below that 80%. So in terms of process so far, we had that informational session with OFM and Commerce on March 28th to talk about the population and housing projections. We had the work session with Council yesterday, here with you all today discussing this. Earlier today, we had the same presentation to the Technical Coordinating Committee. We're going to have a hearing with Council on April 18th, and then we're going to work with Scott Bailey, the Employment Security Department, to come up with an employment projection based on the information we get from the population projection that's selected. And then we'll have we'll discuss that with the Planning Commission and work session in July, and have a hearing with Council. We'll have a work session and a hearing with Council in July. That concludes my presentation. If you have any questions.
Okay, we'll run down. Bryant, do you have any questions?
No questions, just a comment. I'm noticing that 30%, over 30% of the new housing is targeted for the 120% of median income and more. So I thought that was just interesting. When we just finished talking about affordable housing. So just FYI, that's just my comment.
Okay, Brian.
Yeah, no questions.
All right, Steve.
No questions, thank you.
All right, Eldon, any questions?
Can you go back to that slide where you show the different steps coming up? I think it was the one previous to this, yeah. So on April 18th, the County Council is going to have a hearing on the population projection, but there's really nothing for us to do then.
Right, this is just an informational item.
This is just information, okay.
Yes, yeah, there's you won't have a hearing or make a recommendation on this.
All right, thank you.
All right, Jack, did you have any questions?
So I have a question and a comment, but so the question is, what is the downside of predicting a high population growth versus the low population growth? What's the impacts to the county? We go, you know what? We think we're actually going to grow just because, you know, of what we're seeing. What happens there?
Well, so part of this is we have to show in our capital facilities plans that we can pay for this growth. And so the amount of land that we'd need, the roads that we'd need to serve the population, it is significant, particularly for the smaller jurisdictions where, you know, to provide the services, they're gonna have to increase rates to expand their sewer lines, their water lines, extended into certain areas. So that's one of the constraints. The other issue is, well, so the check on this is that this is a 20-year projection. We're back in 10 years to update the plan. So we do this every 10 years. So it's kind of a rolling number. And so we'll plan for 20, but you're never going to get to that because we're going to come back and revisit in 10 years. So yeah, I think that's really the kind of the cost factor.
Okay. So I guess one of the things, you know, the biggest driver right now that you hear and everything is the affordable housing and how that ties into everything. If we as a county decide on a lower projection or lower projections, it restricts land and it restricts development opportunities, which by virtue increases just our baseline cost to develop. You know, I mean, our single family lots are right around 200,000 right now. Just so that's your baseline start. And we got Ridgefield going, you know, crazy with some impact fee stuff that's increasing the baseline significantly. One of the ways to combat that ever increasing, because we're already in a housing deficit, that if we did push forward a higher projection, it is painful from the long range planning side, the development side, what we have to capital facility side, but it is also necessary if we want to start bending that cost curve down for development, because as long as we constrain supply, we're going to continue to drive up costs. So I really want the staff to seriously consider that, because on the short end, we look at it and go, man, we're gonna have to plan for these roads and figure out how to pay for it. But on the flip side of that is, if we don't, we're actually already paying for it in lot costs. So instead of $100,000 for a lot, we're paying $200,000 for a lot. So really want to push staff on thinking through some of the other implications, because it's not just, we're not operating in a vacuum, I guess. So that's my comment there.
Right. And I think that I'd remind you also that if you look, not all of the jurisdictions have even annexed all of the land within their urban growth areas. So there's land there that they haven't annexed yet. What we just did with 179th Street, lifting the urban holding there, is just starting. You know, those large lots come in and those are the first things that go, but there's 2,000 acres in that, I think, area there. And there's a lot of that land that hasn't been developed yet.
I
understand. I'm just saying that. I agree.
Yeah, more is better.
It's definitely constraints
from a cost reduction standpoint. That's
right.
All I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for the presentation.
Sure.
Okay. With that, I guess my only comment is be careful what you wish for. If you look at the medium number and say, okay, this is what we think it's going to be, and if we're looking at that now, but then we go, okay, now we want to open it up and we're going to bring in as much land as we possibly can, so we're going to lower the price of land. Well, that all that land is going to be lower price, so it's going to be built really, really fast. It's going to go fast, and then we're out of land again. So I think there's this happy medium balance, unfortunately, that has to be met between unbridled growth and I don't want to say restricted, because it's not restricted. It's, this is what we think we're going to have for growth, and it's the best educated guess we have. And so I think we got to be careful about how much land, what do we want our county to look like when we're done? That's what do I want my great-grandchildren? I'm going to have great-grandchildren in about another 10 years. So I'm going to be around for that. I want to leave Clark County still beautiful and having all this green space and open space, but we start opening and just bringing it all in, man. I mean, I just see what Ridgefield's, how we've grown, and it's just obliterated the quality of life in Ridgefield at a certain point from somebody who's lived there their entire life. So I say, let's be very careful on how much land we open up. Let's make sure it's based on factual information. That's my thing, Jose, and I think what you guys have done is fantastic. So thanks, Jose. And with that, I think, unless there's any comments from anybody, I'll just open it up to any comments. Jose, are you all done, right?
I do have an update that I need to share with you all.
Oh, okay. Jose, go ahead.
So, let's see. March 22nd, we got a final decision and order from the Growth Management Hearings Board on the appeal of the Chelachi Bluff surface mining overlay. And they've ruled that the county had improperly made a determination of non-significance with respect to the surface mining overlay application. They concluded that the ordinance approving the SMO did not comply with the Growth Management Act and is invalid as interfering with the GMA goals because of the CEPA violation. So the consequence of that is that for the Chelachi Bluff and the Cardi Hill, we are withdrawing the DNS for those applications, and we are issuing a DS for both of those. For Cardi Hill, there won't be any no action that'll be taken until that EIS is completed. For Chelachi Bluff, we may come back to the Planning Commission to take a look at that and make an amendment to the adopting ordinance that the council had adopted based on that recommendation. So that may come back. Oliver's out of town, so when he comes back and based on conversation with counsel, legal counsel, we'll see what our next steps are going to be for that. But we have issued a DS on those.
Okay, and DS, for those that don't know, what does that stand
determination,
for?
Determination. It's a determination of significance and requires an environmental impact statement.
Okay, thank you. Just want to make sure, sure everybody knew what that meant. Okay, thank you for that update on that. We'll look forward to hearing back from you in the future on that one. And with that, is there any comments or questions from anybody on the Planning Commission?
Oh, I just want to make a quick point of this, Jack Arun, point of clarification there. I wasn't advocating for unbridled development of just opening up all the land. And I certainly understand what when we were talking about Ridgefield. I'm a huge proponent of density and figuring out how we can create livable communities in a smaller environment. I think my thinking is just more along the lines of how can we achieve some, you know, that we can do both. That may, you know, increase the density in that environment with, but perhaps having a more aggressive population outlook can help push some of the codes that allow for some of that, those opportunities. And I think what we reviewed earlier today is a great first step in a lot of those things. So. Yeah, I'm not looking to become Houston if that's the if that's the model.
All right. And thanks,
Steve Jack. Marash here. I just wanted to say I agree with what Jack has said, particularly what he said earlier and what he just said now. In the past, the county has never really asked the Planning Commission for its deliberations on, you know, what the appropriate growth rate should be. So, and it doesn't look like based on this schedule they're asking us to do that, but I mean, to the extent they are asking, I want to be on record saying I agree with what Jack said.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
All right. With that said, we'll adjourn.
Okay.
Thank you.